Is called order. It's 1:05, April 26th, Wednesday. Present for the record are Representatives Coghill, Cott, Anderson, and McGuire. Sadly, we only have five items on the agenda. I wish we had everything left in the committee. Could get it through in about 10 minutes. We'll start with House Bill 316, then Senate Bill 206, then House Bill 322, and then we're going to roll House Bill 502 to Friday. And that'll be the only item on the agenda. So without further ado, Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be here to present a bill. It's out of necessity. We have a board that governs the activities of the of attorneys in Alaska. We have to have attorneys, and we have to have a board, so the extension is before us. And as it's before you right now, it's in extending for 3 years. They're differing amounts. When I put in the bill, the sunset recommended somewhere near a decade, I think a little less, came out subsequent to me introducing pre-filing the bill. So, but I'm not a big fan of longer extensions, and this is a traditionally, it's the extensions have been in the four-year range. So, I know this is certainly one. There's the legal community, the profession. It's public interfaces with it. It affects so many aspects of Alaskans' life, as well as our government, the activities that the bar is associated with. So it's certainly appropriately before this committee, and I'll leave it before the discussion and the wisdom of the men.
Two questions for you. First, were there any other recommendations that you looked at made by LBNA that you considered adopting?
Madam Chair, the issue of the disclosure was one issue, and I looked very briefly at the continuing legal education, and the more people I talked to about that, it seemed like it wasn't that didn't serve a public purpose. So it served purposes, but not necessarily a good public purpose. So I didn't.
And on the disclosure,
I certainly I see merit in that, but I didn't set the bill on any course because I figured, knowing the membership of this committee, there would be ideas on this committee, yeah. And I didn't want to prescribe any direction.
Fair enough. Okay, there are three people online to testify, or pardon me, to answer questions. And Representative Guerra has joined us. John Ketcher, Steve Van Gore, and Deborah O'Regan. Any questions further for the sponsor? Okay, thank you, Representative Stoltz,
thank
for
you
coming down. Okay, John, and I'll go to each of you that are online, and if you wish to make a statement, great, or if you just, it looks like you're just here to answer questions, but John Ketcher?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, we met before. I'm the president of our association.
Yes.
And we look forward to and hope that the bill will pass. We are interested in the maximum extension of sunset that the legislature will allow us, and we'd be pleased to answer any questions that the committee may have for us.
Questions? Okay. Steve Van Gore? Someone else, too?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I really don't have any prepared remarks, but I'd be happy to answer any questions. My responsibility is to act as disciplinary counsel and general counsel to the board, so if there are any questions the committee has concerning the disciplinary system, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Okay, it looks like there is Representative Anderson.
Hi, Steve. This is Tom Anderson. I just have one question. How could you leave District 19? You moved.
Through the chair, Representative Anderson, as you know, sir, we all have higher authorities that we respond to, and my wife wanted to move.
Thank you.
Oh, that's great.
Is that why I live in South Anchorage?
Well, we just have the bill. Do we have a CS?
Yes, it turns out, huh? Deborah O'Regan.
Representative McGuire, I'm going to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Okay, and then we have...
Okay, every school teacher I ever had
John Timison, okay. Welcome to House Judiciary.
Madam Chair.
Very briefly, Madam Chair, what was the disclosure requirement you asked about?
Well, it's a good question. I'm going to hold the bill over and look at it and bring it back up Friday and move the bill out. So I have no intent of delaying the bill any further than it already has been. But as it is this time of year, there's so many things on your agenda. But earlier, there was an LBNA report that came back recommending some disclosure opportunities for members of the public who might want to be able to see if there have been disciplinary actions and so on. And the discussion that I had with Mr. Ketcher was that the Bar Association was already looking at that at some level. But, you know, it is, in my humble opinion, a privilege that the Bar Association is self-regulated. And it's a privilege that comes with a lot of responsibility. It's the only professional organization that has that status in the state of Alaska. In fact, in many states, it is not that way. And so I think with it comes an added level of responsibility, and that disclosure recommendation, I think, might be a good one. I want to look at it. And I haven't gotten a chance to, so that's a plain and simple fact.
Madam Chair.
Sure. Mr. Ketcher?
I'm sorry, this is Steve Van Gorder. Madam Chairman. We're getting a little bit of feedback. The recommendation, if I may, from the legislative budget and audit person was that there be a public disclosure of public discipline on the bar's website. That is something that the Bar Association has always planned to do. We're in the midst of transferring our current database to a new database that we hope to have online, hopefully later this summer or this fall, and that information would, of course, be available publicly on the website. But I hasten to add that it's already available to any person who calls or writes the Bar Association and asks for public disciplinary information. My staff is responsive to phone calls, to letters, to faxes, and so forth. So we already are providing public information about public discipline that's been imposed on lawyers or public proceedings. And this recommendation from the committee is certainly one that we endorse, and that is putting it on the bar's website, and we hope to have that later this year.
Representative Kara?
Madam Chair, John, this is probably for you or for Deborah. You guys have known about a source of frustration I've had, and I'm trying to refrain from talking about my own personal problem with the Bar Association on a bill that is a matter of general public policy, but I'm having a hard time biting my tongue on this one. So here, I have a proposal for you. I'm wondering whether or not you would oppose it. The only reason that I and some other members pay $200 a year to remain inactive members is so we don't have to take the bar exam again when we decide to practice law again. It's probably going to be 10 years before I practice law again, and I'm not really so thrilled that I've got to pay $2,000 in the meantime just so I don't have to take the bar exam again. Would you have any problem with an amendment to this bill that provides that the failure to remain an inactive member shall not be grounds for making a member of the bar exam have to take it again when they decide to become a member and reactivate their membership?
Through Madam Chairman, Representative Guerra, you and I have discussed this on a number of occasions, I think speaking for myself, certainly, and I think for the bar as well, we respectfully disagree with your position that it's inappropriate for us to charge inactive members the annual $200 fee. And I think that $180. And I think that the fee is justified for a number of reasons. In my mind, bar dues are more than having lawyers pay for the privilege of membership in the Bar Association. They are also a means of providing the resources for the Bar Association to serve the public. And while there are some lawyers such as yourself, sir, who we actually look forward and welcome your resumption of the active practice of law.
But what else are you going to say? really?
Getting down to the heart of the matter, and I appreciate the hurry up from the chair. I think procedurally, a matter such as this is essentially a revision of the rules that are promulgated by the court, and to have standards coming from the legislature about how bar dues are created and administered is really something that belongs within the province of the Supreme Court rather than within the province of the legislature.
Representative Guerra?
Well, we do disagree about this, John, and I value your friendship, but I can't let myself disagree with somebody just because I value their friendship. There's a certain monopolistic aspect of the Bar Association that's always troubled me. When I first took the bar exam, I promised myself after I became a member I would challenge the rule that says once you take the multi-state and pass it in another state, that's not allowed to wave in Alaska. The only validity to the multi-state is that it's the same exact test in every single state of the country, and this Bar Association doesn't allow the multi-state to wave in here. And what happens is, therefore, as you know, since the multi-state exam is complete Greek even to lawyers, we have to take a Barbary exam, we have to spend $1,000, we have to take 2 weeks off of work so we can take the same exact exam again in Alaska. Some other states allow it to wave in. We don't. And I remember during the testimony on that, when I proposed that rule many years after I passed the bar exam, one person who was also a friend of mine said, well, we don't want to make it so easy for people to come in from out of state to practice. I just found that very monopolistic. And I don't see that too far afield from this whole idea that the Bar Association, in my view, is protecting its current membership by having their fees subsidized by people who are no cost to the Bar Association, who don't practice law, who don't make the income that attorneys make. You know, this is costing me somewhere around close to about 0.5% or 1% of my annual income just so I don't have to take the bar exam again. I'm not going to do an amendment because, frankly, this is something that is my personal concern, but it really annoys me. There's really a sort of self-preservation aspect of the Bar Association that I have never, ever liked. And on both of those issues, one of them I did it after I passed the bar exam, so it had nothing to do with my own personal circumstance. This one does have to do something with my own personal circumstance, but there is a self-preservation aspect of the bar exam that I really have a huge problem with. And there's probably no question there, John. I mean, I know you disagree, so you don't have to respond.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're dealing with just the bill itself, no CS or anything. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. First of all, I need to put on the record that I'm a member of the bar and I have a conflict of interest and therefore asked to be excused from participating.
And I object.
You're excused.
Yes!
For the rest of the committee. Just teasing.
Is there an objection?
There's an objection.
Okay, thank you.
From myself.
Thank you. If not from the other two. They're glad to get rid of me. Okay, the other thing is that I wanted to put on the record that I'm very pleased that just recently the Board of Governors is recommending mandatory CLE rule change. That's mandatory. Excuse me, continuing legal education rule change, and that will then be sent out to the members of the bar for their comments, and then the Board of Governors will review it and hopefully send it to the Supreme Court. And I think that is excellent. I had expressed an interest in requiring that legislatively if the bar didn't do it themselves and the Supreme Court. And I'm not saying what it needs to be, but I think that it is excellent that you are doing that through the chair. I think that that's protecting the public and also good for the bar members too, because it makes us do a little outside studies and it may cost a little bit, but it's good for us personally to keep up with the law, which is so fast changing, and it's good for the public, and it's good for the bar image. And I just want to put that on the record and to thank you. And I'm pleased to be a co-
interrupted your soon-to-be testimony.
I was pleased to be a co-prime on the bill.
I need to warn you that this, whenever the Bar Association issues come up here, it becomes a circus on this committee, and we all start venting. So,
the Chair, Representative Guerra, I fully expected to come down here to take one for the team, so it's okay. I appreciate it.
Drew the short straw.
That's right. Madam Chair, I drew the short straw because I am president-elect of the Alaska Bar Association, John Temison. In 36 hours, I will become president of the Alaska Bar Association.
But
currently, President Kacher has other duties in Anchorage because our annual convention is occurring right now.
Are you living in Fairbanks?
I am from Fairbanks. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
And do you prefer your last name or president?
Chair, I'm very happy to prefer my last name, although, frankly, president is easier to pronounce. I have not yet become quite fully heady with the power that I soon to possess. We are here to recommend advancement of the bill. It is good for Alaskans. It is good for the public. The first lawyers were licensed to practice law in the state of territory of Alaska in the 1880s. The current Organized Bar Act created the present Bar Association as an instrumentality of the territory in 1955. Today, we have more than 2,800 active in-state members that we serve, and more importantly, we have all the citizens of the state of Alaska that we serve and protect. We serve the Alaska through a 12-member Board of Governors, which consists of 9 attorney members, 3 public members, including Michael Hurley, who's also present here, and through 17 dedicated bar staff. We appreciate the opportunity to speak with the members of the committee individually a month or two ago. We appreciate the opportunity to speak and answer questions from the full committee. Sunset gives us a rare opportunity to come forward quadrennially, is what it's been, to speak with the committee and to interact with the legislature. Frankly, every 4 years, we would like to do it more often, but we'd like to do it not necessarily in the context of Sunset. And one of the things that I would think would be important for us to do would be to set a time where we can meet perhaps with the judiciary chairs or with the full committee, if that's your preference, on an annual basis, and I'd be happy to do that as bar president and continue that. Again, just so that we're not meeting either in the context of only of Sunset or when there's some sort of crisis or potential conflict, that we're actually having a dialogue between the legislature and the bar.
I don't disagree, but one of the things that I think is important to remember about the sunsetting process, not just to pick on the Bar Association, but for all of the boards and commissions at Sunset, is that very important check and balance that is envisioned. And so the idea is that we are sort of delegating out a state function, if you will, to individuals in the community to manage it. And then the idea is that the legislature, representatives of the people, ought to have the ability then to see how that's going. How is that progressing? What changes need to occur? I often hear this concept of, we want a clean sunset bill. And I think folks who say that perhaps aren't looking at the entire role that we have and the interaction. So I appreciate what you have to say. It sounds like you're going to be a good president, but please don't take the interaction that you have with us, suggestions, even possible amendments, and so on as hostile, but rather I think it's more a part of our very important legislative function.
Madam Chair, we absolutely understand and agree, and that was exactly where I was going, is that frankly, although we're not we would like to have, again, more dialogue and more interaction with the legislature, not necessarily in an oversight role, but just the fact that we don't really talk very much. We don't interact very much with the legislative branch. We don't interact a whole lot with the governor's office, except in times of conflict or crisis. We interact quite often with the court system, but again, we understand that as an instrumentality of the state, we have obligations to all the branches of government. And in that context, we appreciated the thoroughness of the audit that occurred. It was by far the most time that legislative auditors have ever spent with our organization. We appreciate the concerns that the audit brought up, and we are prepared to address those. Our 2005 annual report is out. The annual report, the lag in annual reporting, has been addressed directly by the board. Just yesterday, we did vote to publish the MCLE rule. Again, disciplinary matters are available to the public, and just unfortunately, there is a software issue that hinders making it available on the website, and we expect to have that software issue resolved by the end of 2006 and no later than the first quarter of 2007. Just yesterday, we approved the contract for that software purchase, so we're moving on that too. Again, we agree with the overall conclusions of the audit, that the Bar Association serves the public well, serves the membership well, and it serves Alaska well. We note that there is no fiscal note to the Bar Association. We have not taken any money from the state of Alaska since 1986. And we have no intention of doing
so
in the future.
It from
That's
left.
Right.
You don't have to.
Conkill had an amendment for $1 million a year. If you want to withdraw that, Deborah's like, no, we'll take it.
I'm gonna waive your fees, members. As a member of the legislature.
Good. Save me $200 and get me unelected for
$180.
$180.
Madam Chair, the two most important things the three things that the Bar Association do are discipline, admissions, and then other. By far, the two most important things that we do are discipline and admissions. And those are, although on the surface they may appear to be a membership directed function, they are not. They are a core service that we provide to the citizens and the public. We assure the Supreme Court and the citizens of Alaska that every applicant for the Alaska Bar is qualified, both ethically and through their competence, to represent citizens of the Alaska before the court. We also, through our discipline process, recertify that every member of the Alaska Bar continues to be worthy of public trust and the trust of the court system, the trust of their clients. Those are responsibilities that we take extremely important to us. There is nothing more important that we do than discipline and admissions. On the other, those are more member services we provide, as pointed out in the audit report, various services including continuing education, the Alaska Law Review, the Alaska Bar Reg, insurance benefits, lawyer referral service, a drug and alcohol referral service, and other various membership services. Again, we are all available for questions from the committee, Madam Chair, and also Michael Hurley, a public member, is available for any questions that any of the members may have.
It's so tempting.
I can't resist the temptation, Madam Chair.
The blood pressure in the committee is just going up. I just feel it. My intent was to bring this up first, put it to the side, and get to the other bills, but I can just feel it. Representative Gruenberg.
Yes. This is to Ms. O'Regan. Deborah, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Did you get the blank fiscal note form we sent you?
Yes, we did. Thank you.
Okay, because I have another one here, and I can give it to Mr. Timmison or Mr. Hurley. Apparently, somebody had asked the bar, and I'm talking to you, John, to do a blank fiscal note. I'm sure my office can assist you in filling that out, or Deborah can. And Madam Chair, I would just ask that they be given until Friday to submit their the bar's fiscal note.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
I'm sorry. I almost want to extend the do the sunset every 30 years so I don't get my blood pressure boiling every 3 years over this.
Objection.
Let me ask you about the question that really has nothing to do about me that makes me even angrier. And certainly I'm never going to use my legislative position to get you guys to change your internal rules. I don't think.
Not yet.
Maybe let me answer.
We've got a couple days to think about it.
But there is this aspect of the Bar Association where they do very well at representing their active members, but not so well representing the people who aren't part of that group who they get to regulate. And the first group who they get to regulate who are not their active members, who have no say in what the Bar Association does, is people who apply to become members of the Bar Association. They have no say. And I would like, I don't just want a response, I would like a positive response to this concern. I can't demand this out of you, but I would like you to think very seriously about it. The multi-state exam is obnoxious. There is merit to it, and that's why every state, I think, requires the multi-state exam, but it's the same in every state. It tests on topics that are so arcane that people who come out of law school have to take another course just to pass the thing. I had to take it twice because I passed the bar in Massachusetts, had to take the course. It cost me, $300-$500 there. I came up to Alaska a year and a half later, and the stuff was so nonsensical that I had to take the course again so I could pass the Alaska bar. The only legitimacy to the multi-state is it's the same everywhere. There is a way that you could just let people wave in here so they don't have to put themselves through the burden of taking that same exact test again. I would really like a thoughtful response to why you make applicants, and not you because you're not bar president yet, but why the Bar Association fights so hard against proposals to let people waive in their multi-state score or come up with some process like other states do to do that. That drives me crazy, and it seems absolutely monopolistic. The one comment from the bar board member who testified against my proposal many, many years ago, very good friend of mine, when she said, we don't want it to be so easy for people to come up here, I thought that hit the nail on the head.
On that point, just briefly before you respond, the way that other states will do it is there's a threshold score that they will set. And so you have to take the exam. Nobody's arguing that, however arcane it is. And I agree with Representative Guerra that, you know, in some cases you're going back to theories and so on that are arcane. That being said, there's a threshold score that is set, and if you meet that threshold score, then you waive in for that portion. That doesn't let you off the hook for the other portions that a state may choose to come up with that ask an applicant to show their competency in an individual state's law. Never mind the fact that there are some states that only require the multi-state exam and don't require anything on top of that, and there are even other states that don't require 3 full days, but that's even a whole nother topic. It's a good question, and I just want to expand just briefly before you respond to Representative Guerra's point. Again, it's difficult because all of us have had some connection with the Bar Association, but if anything, I think it makes us more knowledgeable. I don't think the average member of the public really cares until they are put in a situation where they need to care. But this really truly is a state issue, because if you're going to license people, if you're going to allow for regulation of individual practice areas, it ought to be fair. And it isn't just that it's fair to those who already get the license. It's got to be fair to the folks who are looking at getting the license. And Representative Guerra is exactly right. Whether it's the medical profession, frankly, whether it's the tattoo artists who we now license, or potentially the radiological technicians who we license, The theory behind it is that we want people to be competent when they practice in the state, if they're licensed, but we don't want to create a system that simply allows for a monopoly and protects only those who have the license, to the detriment, I would argue, not only of those who might want entry into it, but to the public. Because after all, the public benefits from a diversity of lawyers to choose from. And so those are my remarks as well, but I'd like a response.
And before you get to the response, I'll add the third level of remark.
I'll give you
an example. I went to law school 96 to 99, and my buddy Steve passed the bar in, I guaranteed I'll give you his name so you don't think it's someone else, but in Missouri. And he had heard that they had legislative legal services positions open. And he was really excited because he says, I've always wanted to work in draft legislation. And I'm like, oh, God, that's so boring. But he said he really wanted to do it. And so he was getting ready to apply, and then he realized the same thing, that he said, I don't want to take that. I barely passed the multi-state, and I don't want to do it. And you've been there. I mean, we've all gone through that. And so he said, I'm not going to do it because I don't want to have to revisit that. And that's a real example. I mean, that's a real, that he would have moved here. He has two kids now, and I think two kids, and he would have been a paying, you know, this barrier of entry, he would have been a thriving good attorney, maybe with legal services, and instead he didn't come just based on that, not wanting to go through that whole litany of testing.
So I guess to narrow the response is, how is it, we understand the competency part, how is asking an applicant who has passed the multi-state, maybe even a very high score on the multi-state, how is asking them to retake that exam, in some instances a full decade later, how is that an indication of their competence if you're already asking them to take an essay question, series of essay questions, that demonstrate your proficiency with respect to Alaska law?
Madam Chair, I empathize with the concern.
They're all ready to talk.
I get cut. Well, what I was going to say is I empathize with the concerns that Representative Anderson brought up. When my wife, who is an attorney and had already passed a bar exam, and I were talking about moving up here, this was a discussion that we had very, very seriously relative to her having to move up here and take another bar exam. So I absolutely empathize with that. However, as far as discussing the actual history and why we have it, I would defer to our executive director, Deborah O'Regan, to answer that question.
And if I may, Madam Chair, this is John Cage, the president, but only for another 35 hours before Timothy gets to take over. And one of the pleasures and honors of being the president is that we have very able bar staff, including Steve Van Gore, who I know has been through this issue both in front of the Alaska Supreme Court and to numerous seminars and studies of this issue on a national basis. So I'd ask that Steve be given the opportunity to speak specifically to the issues that have been raised.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett and Madam Chair, the multi-state bar exam is everything that you say it is. I had to take it in Kansas when I was initially admitted in 1975 and in Alaska in 1978 when I was admitted here. It is probably the most difficult multiple choice exam ever invented by man. I guess I'll go on record as saying that. The reason that the multi-state is required for all applicants has nothing to do with limiting admission, limiting the numbers of persons who can practice law in Alaska. The reason, pure and simple, is scientific. Our testing expert, Dr. Stephen Klein from the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, California, was instrumental in designing, I guess, the sea change in the exam in the early 80s. Prior to, I believe it was 1982 or 81, the Alaska exam consisted of one day of California questions, a half day of Alaska questions, and the multi-state bar examination. Because of the small size of our bar back at that time, the California portion of the California day of questions was actually sent back to California and graded by California examiners. Mm-hmm. Well, there came a time when California decided, we don't want to do that anymore, you're going to have to do it yourself, And so Dr. Klein was consulted. The model that he came up with is the model basically that we use today, and that is a day of Alaska questions, a half day of long essay questions, a half day of short essay questions. We used to draft our own research and writing question individually, but we now use a research and writing question offered to us by the National Conference of Bar Examiners. And the other component is, again, our old friend, the multi-state bar exam. There was a time when the multi-state bar exam score could be transferred from another state and used in the computations to figure whether an applicant passed the exam or not. But what Dr. Klein pointed out is that there is greater precision, to use his words, in using the same pool of results from applicants who take the multi-state and applicants who take the essay exam when it comes to combining those scores. In other words, you want the same universe of people taking the multi-state as the same universe of people taking the essay examination. There are three different ways of equating or combining the multi-state exam scores and the essay scores. But the standard that we've been using, at least I think for the last eight or nine or perhaps longer years, is a standard deviation method. And what that does is basically allow us to compare statistically the range of performance of this class of applicants taking the multi-state with the range of performance of the same class of applicants taking the essay exam. And as you may know, what we do after we get those scores is combine the two, divide by two, and applicants who have a combined score of 140 or above pass the examination. Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I agree with you wholeheartedly about the difficulty of the multi-state exam. And I wish I could recall the board member who may have commented that it was intended to limit admission. I assure you it is not. The purpose for doing it the way we're doing it has a scientific base. Dr. Klein, if he were to testify, would tell you that the correlation of performance or predictability of performance by doing it this way gives the Alaska bar exam a high degree of credibility. And essentially, a scientific reason is the reason that we're doing it.
And then just in response to that, there would be a way, however, to use a similar model by simply taking a person's multi-state score and then combining it. And I think what you're trying to get at is you don't want the perception or the reality that your subjective part of your examination is in some way flawed. That being said, it reminds me the professional responsibility. There's a multi-state professional responsibility exam you take as well, which you do take independently and then does follow you in most states. Thankfully, Alaska has chosen to at least accept that, and that's good for 5 years. So there is some, I guess I would say, precedent for that. Anyway, let's keep talking for a second, and then I'm going to set the bill to the side so that our blood pressure can go down and we can talk about material witnesses. Representative Guerra.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thanks, Steve. I had the pleasure of presenting my bar rule change on the multi-state at the bar. And I believe Dr. Klein did testify. I think he's the psychologist from California who the Bar Association used as their expert. What became clear during that hearing, I remember being quite displeased that Dr. Klein didn't respond to the questions. What became quite clear that what you could do would be to take the 140 score or whatever half the last, take the last bar exam and figure out whatever half the score was and say that's the acceptable multi-state exam score. Maybe it's 140. And then for those applicants who have the 140 and wave in, score them separately on the Alaska portion so their results don't contaminate the results of the people who are taking both parts of the exam, because it is easier to take one part than it is to take two parts. And for those people who've waived it on the multi-state, their Alaska score has to be as high as half the score of those people who passed who took both parts in the current exam. It's not like it can't be done, and I remember Dr. Klein, I believe, is the person that came up with many arguments for why it couldn't be done when it could. I don't feel uncomfortable saying I and Judge Tan and others have been quite displeased with the Bar Association's response on this issue.
You know, the other point I'd make too is that there is a rule. Just wrapping this up, that allows for reciprocity and waiver in. So just think about the principle of that in and of itself. You're saying that an individual who has taken a bar exam in another state that may have allowed for a waiver of a multi-state score, may have even only required a multi-state score, may have been Washington State, which requires no multi-state at all, has practiced in that state for 5 years, has met all of the ethical background checks and so on, can now waive in to practice, and then is ultimately up, I would say, at the service of Alaskans who may choose to employ this individual as a result of your allowing them to be waived in through the Supreme Court. And yet this person sits alongside someone else who may choose to come to Alaska and actually sit for the part of the exam that demonstrates competency in Alaska law, and utilize the multi-state score that exists out there. I mean, if you really think about it, that's the part that's inane to me. I mean, it's that you've really got an individual who's saying, I'll step up to the plate, I'll take an exam, and even show you that I know Alaska law, as opposed to simply waving in from another state and maybe have no knowledge whatsoever of Alaska law. So how can you reconcile the two of those concepts?
Madam Chair, with all respect, the maze that you had in there, there are limitations on reciprocity rule, and I believe the limitations on which state, we don't have universal reciprocity. The limitations on which states we do have reciprocity with, I believe, address those concerns. But again, I defer to Mr. Van Gore to discuss the specifics of the reciprocity rule and how it applies.
For example, when you're responding, Mr. Van Gore, don't we have reciprocity with Washington State?
Madam Chair, this is Steve Van Gore. Yes, we do have reciprocity with Washington State, and you are correct that Washington doesn't require the MBE. However, Washington also doesn't require the MPRE that we require up here, and instead an Alaska applicant to the Washington Bar would have to go down to Washington and take their Washington ethics examination in order to qualify for reciprocity admission. So Deborah O'Regan is very fond of saying that Alaska has no reciprocity with warm states. I think that's probably a truism. I believe we have reciprocity with a little less than half of the state.
No, about 30 states.
About 30 states. And so this basically is, I guess reciprocity is designed to be an accommodation to lawyers who, in these other states, have done two important things. They passed a written bar examination in their state, however that's constituted, and they practiced 5 of the last 7 years in the active practice of law. And the active practice of law can be defined a number of different ways. It can be a traditional private practice. It could be government practice. It could be practice in a situation where a license to practice a license to practice is a requirement for the position. All of those things factor into whether a person qualifies for reciprocity admission. It is true that reciprocity applicants are not tested specifically on Alaska law, but by the same token, neither is an Alaska attorney who seeks admission in another reciprocal state required to demonstrate or to take whatever portion of the exam covers the law in that state. And I think the reciprocity rules that Alaska has adopted and other states have adopted reflect what I think is going to be more and more a national trend. and that is that clients should be able to select lawyers of their choosing to do work of their choosing without particular regard to where that lawyer may be living or where that lawyer may have an office. Obviously, the realities of electronic practice are with us now, the ability to practice in a number of states. And I guess peering into the crystal ball, I think we will likely come to a situation where our relations with other countries on an international scale is going to cause more and more of a national licensure than the current balkanization that we have with state licenses. How do I assure that a lawyer from Washington who didn't take the Alaska portion of the exam demonstrates competency? I guess what I would respond, Madam Chairman, is that the very first rule of the rule of professional conduct requires a lawyer to be competent, and that requires the necessary study, experience, or whatever, or the desire to become proficient in a particular area of law. So if a lawyer coming up from Washington on reciprocity desires to practice law in Alaska, that lawyer will be held to the same standard that an Alaska lawyer will be held to in terms of knowledge of Alaska law and proper application of Alaska law. But I think reciprocity, you know, basically reflects more or less a reality of interstate practice, perhaps more in the lower 48 than up here because we have no bordering states. But I think historically that's the reason that Alaska has moved along with reciprocity.
Well, and I think historically the reason it has is because your main job is to serve the lawyers that are already licensed, and those lawyers want the ability to practice in other states, to be blunt.
I think you're absolutely right, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson, and then...
And I'm sure two things. One, I wanted Steve and Deborah to know that Representatives Cott and Coghill are in the fetal position right now, begging for mercy. No, but secondly, I want to entertain Representative Guerra did have an amendment that John Ketcher, Steve Van Gore, and Deborah O'Regan's cell and phone numbers be given to the Obermeyer family. I would vote for that.
I would... While we're having fun, should we bring Wyrock, Berkowitz, and Kutula down here?
Yeah. They have issues, too. Representative Groenberg.
Yes, I would ask Ms. O'Regan or your staff, if you wouldn't mind getting to this committee, please, a list of the states and other jurisdictions, which may include territories and District of Columbia, et cetera, that do have reciprocity or partial reciprocity with Alaska. And if it's partial or there's some condition on it, if that could be noted on the list. If you have, Ms. O'Regan, do you have such a list easily available?
Representative Groenberg, such a list is available on our website, and I can make that available to you. There are no states that we have partial reciprocity with.
Yeah, if you could do that, just get a copy up here to us. If I could ask the staff, Shalon Szymanski, to just so that could be distributed by Friday. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to set the bill aside. Thank you very much, President-elect. Actually, by the time the bill comes up again, you may be president.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And I hear Mr. Ketcher.
Mr. Ketcher would hope so. And when it passes, you'll be outgoing president. Just kidding.
Through the chair, one of my primary goals of my presidential year is to not have to turn the lights out on this organization.
Madam Chair,
Representative Garrett, and then Cott.
I think it's our approach. I think we get so frustrated, we yell at these guys, and nobody ever comes back with a solution because I think they're scared of us.
So. I think so too.
I'll try a different approach next year.
Cott.
Sure. I think based on discussions with this multi-state testing, I think Coghill and I have foregone the idea of going to law school.
Just go straight to the Barbary course. You don't need law school.
Yeah, exactly.
Barbary Coast?
Yeah. Of course.
Benefits Representative Croft. Say it again.
Barbary
Coast. Okay. Senator Bundy, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. At least you didn't offer
thank Mr. Hurley for his... Mike!
It is so stressful.
Thank you for your elegant testimony.
I just get so frustrated. I just can't stand it.
I promise myself.
Answers.
Madam Chair, committee members, good afternoon. Before I begin, I have to share my CPA story with you. I knew a fellow in, I think it's very relevant to what you're talking about, I knew a fellow in college whose brother-in-law was a pretty good accountant, but he was having a real tough time being a CPA. And the CPA exam is something like the bar exam. It's a very grueling.
It is, yeah.
And this poor guy took the exam several times, finally just squeaked by, just passed. He wasn't a CPA for 6 months before he was demanding that they increase the difficulty of the test because there are just too many CPAs.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Nothing like guarding your own hen house. Well,
for the record, after I got in, I tried to make it easier, so I was trying to destroy my own hen house.
Right,
I think.
To the exception to the rule.
Oh, maybe we can import more foxes. Madam Chair, that brings us, has nothing to do with Senate Bill 206. I appreciate an opportunity to present the bill to you. Genesis of this bill is something most of you are probably too familiar with. They had a gangbanger shooting in Diamond Center this last year, and I, with many, watched with amazement on the news when the police tried to detain some of the participants for questioning, and the participants basically flipped the police off and said, "See ya, I'm getting in a cab, and I'll go and seek retribution on my own. I don't need the cops." I was amazed that Alaska doesn't have some kind of a material witness bill. And I talked with Chief Monaghan in Anchorage, and he expressed his concern and what he wanted. And then I talked to Legal Services and found out that what he wanted just wasn't possible. It was other issues you've reviewed here, it was unconstitutional. And so what we have here is another attempt to give the police the tools they need to protect us from the bad guys and not interfere with the rights of the good guys. And I think after dealing extensively with particularly Mr. Guinelli, I think we've achieved that in this bill. This bill does balance the need to protect individual freedoms with the ability to prosecute crime and, really important, and I didn't think of it at the time, to provide defendants with witnesses on their behalf. I was only thinking about the prosecution half, but after we talked about this, it's also incredibly important to be able to provide witnesses for defendants. In whether it's defense or prosecution, a material witness is crucial, of course, to to a trial. Unfortunately, all too often, material witnesses refuse to cooperate with law enforcement officials. This significantly impeding the ability to bring indictments or prosecute a crime. Senate Bill 206 protects material witnesses from unreasonable arrest or confinement and helps to assure the availability of crucial testimony. It does this by adding a section to AS 1250, which allows a police officer to temporarily detain a person under circumstances that give the officer reasonable suspicion of three things. One, the person witnessed a crime or was in the vicinity of a crime, such as a homicide or a manslaughter. Two, the person may have information of material aid to the investigation of that crime. And three, the temporary detention is a reasonable necessity to obtain or verify the identification of the person, to obtain an account of the crime, to protect the crime victim from imminent harm, and other circumstances. The as we've talked with the Chief Monaghan, he had suggested that this actually might be a tool that helps some people who are involved in perhaps on the border or on the edge of legal problems. If they volunteered to be a witness in a crime, they may put themselves in serious jeopardy. If, however, the police say, you have to talk to me, you have to give me your identification, they can cooperate without putting themselves in jeopardy. The other thing that the police want to be able to do, of course, is in a volatile situation is sit down and talk to me for a minute, give me your identification, give me your version of what happened, and stop the immediate retribution cycle that I think we've seen too often in Anchorage with the gang problem. So the bill basically allows a police officer who has detained a person under the circumstances I mentioned to photograph the person, to serve them with a subpoena, to take a person's fingerprints if the crime under investigation is murder, attempted murder, or misconduct involving weapons in the first degree. It allows a person that receives one of these subpoenas to request the district attorney to withdraw the subpoena if the person can prove a valid, provide a valid government-issued photographic ID prior to any grand jury proceedings. Makes it a Class B misdemeanor to refuse or resist the taking of photographs or fingerprints, and the bill also contains outlines for the retention or destroying these photographs or fingerprints. And it also increases the penalty for contempt of court for failure to honor a subpoena or refusal to answer as a witness in connection to a felony crime or appear before a grand jury. Madam Chair, as I said, if it were up to me, I guess I would be a little more cavalier about constitutional rights, of course, unless it came to my turn.
Right. But
working with the Department of Law, I think we have achieved a balance to provide the police with a little more of equipment to be able to investigate some of these violent crimes that are becoming far too often a factor of our everyday life, but at the same token, not allowing people to rights to be trampled on. So with that, I commend the bill to your study.
Thank you, Representative, pardon me, Senator Bunny. Questions?
I used to sit over there. Call me a representative.
Representative Guerra.
Mr. Chair, Con, there are four quick issues as I look through this, and I can't tell you that you'll get this to a point where I can support it, but actually I think you might, I'm sure you need my vote to pass this, but
who is kidding, Con?
I understand the whole concept of the mall shooting. You see witnesses there, they run away, you never find them again, whether or not they flip the police officers off or not, and I understand the concern there. But there are parts of the bill, I think, that you wouldn't need in order to get those witnesses' addresses. So let me go through a couple things. I'll go through them quick and then maybe one at a time. There's the ability to stop somebody just if they were in the vicinity, regardless of whether they were at the scene of the crime or you had any belief that they saw the crime. It says, I think, reasonable cause to believe they were in the vicinity. And I don't really like that part. That seems too broad, in the neighborhood. Why don't we do it one at a time?
Madam Chair, if I could answer that. As I understand it, some of the most unreliable people are eyewitnesses because we are very selective in what we perceive. And this was their, police officer has to obviously use judgment. But perhaps he thought I had seen, can't hear?
Heard something.
Or heard something.
I heard a gunshot.
It didn't really register until someone asked me about it. And then I said, oh, yeah, I remember just the other night I was walked into the parking lot and there was this very tall teenager painting something on the wall back there. And I could have been an unintentional witness. As it was, I was very intentional. But that's the whole point, that maybe something happened that wasn't at your real focus or conscious level, and had someone asked you about it, then indeed you may have brought it up to conscious level.
All right, that's the end of the vicinity issue. What it means, in fairness to you, if you have reasonable suspicion the person was in the vicinity and
quote, may have information, but I think that's everybody that's in the vicinity, because may have isn't a very high standard. We always do things where you detain citizens, and here we're detaining innocent citizens often. It makes no distinction between witnesses who are guilty and witnesses who've done nothing wrong. We usually use the standard probable cause as opposed to the lower standard reasonable suspicion, and so I'd be much more comfortable with the standard we normally use of probable cause. And that would satisfy the mall issue. You see the kids, they're right there, they're watching the whole thing. You're darn right you had probable cause that they were witnesses. So you would still be able to deal with the mall shooting issue with the probable cause standard. I guess, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, again, if they provide the photo ID, there's no detention necessary at all. This is just to provide the photo ID. If they don't provide the photo ID, then you may have to detain them long enough to fingerprint them or photograph them. And of course, I don't know of any guilty witnesses. I think that's probably something that has to take place in trial. So when we're investigating a crime, again, the best judgment of the police officer.
But I think in Article 3 it says you may temporarily detain the person if you have reasonable suspicion that they're essentially possibly a witness. And mm-hmm. What would be wrong with saying you can't detain them unless you have probable cause as opposed to reasonable suspicion?
Well, as Robert Service says, I'm not as wise as some of them lawyer guys, and I may have indeed defer to legal and or Chief Monaghan.
Let me go to the other two, and then we can ask them to... can you, for the witnesses, and we're presuming the witnesses are innocent, though I think in the mall shooting case they were questionably innocent, but maybe they were innocent. I have some problem fingerprinting an innocent person or taking a police photo of an innocent person. Are we only doing that if they don't have ID, or are we doing that even if they do have ID?
If they fail to provide ID, or if, in the case of the photograph, if they're involved in attempted murder or misconduct involving weapons of first degree, the idea is now we're going around asking, have you seen this? We can't locate the witness now. Have you seen this person? We've got a photograph.
And then are we allowing the subpoena? I understand the subpoena is to get you to the grand jury, to get you to the trial. The subpoena wouldn't let you subpoena a witness or an innocent person just to get them to come in to do a photo or fingerprints, right?
No.
Okay. I think those are my biggest concerns, apart from whether or not I still have a philosophical problem with the whole idea of detaining people who you need as witnesses on one hand, but who are innocent on the other. So,
understand the philosophical balance.
Absolutely. Representative Gruenberg.
Okay, I haven't really studied this, Senator, but I've just got a few preliminary questions.
I could just suggest you follow my lead then.
Well, we did it once on the seatbelt bill and it got us all in trouble.
Next doesn't understand that type of humor, Con.
Still getting messages about
okay,
that.
I will throttle
but
my
let's take it. Let's take it from the top here. I have been
suddenly.
I've been involved in family law cases involving contempts, and I've actually had trials on contempt. And it's a very important safeguard when people disregard court orders, and it can be extremely extremely helpful. And what I'm interested to hear, since we very seldom get a bill dealing with ASO 9.50, the contempt stuff, in using this, because it's a very old statute, and we can really, and the title's broad enough, we can really here help it out. And I'm looking at the underlined language. Or if the failure to honor a subpoena or refusal to be sworn or answer as a witness, and this is the phrase, was in conjunction with the felony or appearance. I would be interested in eliminating that phrase because it's very serious in any case if a witness doesn't answer a subpoena. And that's grounds for a bench warrant and it should also be ground for a contempt citation. And I don't think it should be limited to just a serious crime, because these come out sometimes in the subpoenaing him for a civil trial or something, and also a potential refusal to answer a question. You have civil contempt where technically you hold the keys in your own pocket, like a newspaper reporter or somebody may refuse to answer a question, and then they're detained until they do. But this also allows a criminal contempt too. And I assume we're going to be looking at this bill in the next couple of days. I'd like you to consider, and I'd like to talk with you, Lauren, in the meantime, not just limiting it to felony crimes, but I want to give those judges some teeth in making witnesses cooperate with legitimate subpoenas and court orders generally. Secondly, the term on page 2, temporarily detained, I think we need to define that, and we should have something generic that says to detain for as long as necessary to achieve the purposes here, but not unreasonably, so they could bring, if necessary, a writ of habeas corpus, and they're just, we don't want a Guantanamo Bay thing here. Number three, the term...
You can't handle the truth.
Thank you, Jack. Great line. I've said that to my constituents sometimes. Can you handle the truth? And they said, yes, yes, tell me. Anyway, page 2, line 9.
Do people mind? We're talking.
The term vicinity, I think we should be talking there, and they talk about vicinity elsewhere, but it's used slightly differently through the chair elsewhere. And this is what Representative Guerra said. I think we should say was in the immediate vicinity, so we're not talking about somebody three blocks away. And then again on line page 2, line 14, again we have the term temporary, which I think should be part of the
Might interject, Madam Chair. I believe the temporary is part of case law at this point, but
is what?
Part of case law.
And I think we should probably put it in here, if we can. I mean, I just want to have you thinking about these things. I'm just bringing them up. And then the phrase on line 16, Madam Chair, everybody, quote, or for other exigent circumstances.
Right.
That's a real barn door. And what I don't know. I think we've got to be careful here. And then page 2, lines 23 and 24. It says a peace officer who temporarily, temporarily here, detains a person under A of this subsection may take the person's fingerprint impressions if, but they limit only a very few statutes. And you could have a circumstance where the crime isn't one of those listed crimes, but it could be a burglary ring or something like that. And the question is, do you want to broaden it to include other crimes? And if so, which ones? And again, Madam Chair, all I'm doing are raising some issues that I spotted. You may think my ideas are lousy. You may think they have some merit. But I'm just raising them because that's all. And then on page 3, finally, where lines 4 and 5, you say, may request the DA to withdraw the subpoena. I think you should also put in there, or may move the court to quash the subpoena, because sometimes the DA may not be willing to do it, but you can always move a court to quash something, and we should put that in there, too, to be technically correct. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I'm happy to work with you folks.
And Senator Bundy, is Annie Carpinetti here on your behalf as well? And if so, would you mind joining us at the table? I'm going to go ahead while Annie's coming up here, and Chief Monaghan is on the line. And Chief, you already had testified in Representative Meyer's bill that as to why you were supporting it. Is there anything that you wanted to add today in terms of your support?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. This is Walt Monaghan, thank you, Police Department, for the record. And what I've been looking over, listening to the concerns, I'd like to make a stab or two at some of the representatives, Guerra's issues, like in the vicinity issue.
Okay.
Normally, our emergency response time is we like to think it's pretty good. But 3 to 4 minutes can put somebody at a pretty good run at a distance from the immediate scene. So as I'm heading into the area, or as an officer's heading into the area, they may spy somebody who, according to the initial locate that they put out, that may be involved or seen in the area. We'd like to be able to stop them and at least try to ascertain who they are, because you know, they're running away from the scene or in a vehicle as they pass by. So the vicinity part I actually kind of enjoy, but and if it happens in on the east side of town, certainly on the west side of town, we shouldn't be looking at that kind of reasonable, because it isn't. So just keep that in mind, and as far as vicinity. In regards to the PC versus probable cause versus reasonable suspicion, I'm sure you're going to have an attorney tell you the legalistic definitions, but understand that probable cause is the level of proof that we need for an arrest, whereas reasonable suspicion is one that we use for a stop, if that helps clarify it most simply. But otherwise, looking at the bill here, I'm looking at on page 3, where on line 11, where it says, must be destroyed upon earlier or the following occurrences. What I'd like is, since we are still trying to sort out initially what is there, and Representative Guerra actually touched upon this a little bit. What if the suspect that we're talking to, or what if the individual that we're talking to, is actually part of the issue? And in essence, what it would be, I could be destroying my matching evidence, so to speak, if compelled to do so as written. So what I would suggest or look, what might be considered, is unless the investigation indicates the person is a suspect in the case, then the photos and fingerprints must be destroyed upon earlier the following occurrences. That way I can cover the guilty witnesses without destroying my evidence, so to speak. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And I certainly appreciate it. There isn't any way in our society that allows, nor should it allow, police to do some of the tactics that they were well known for back before all of us were born. I'm throwing you in there too, Con. In regards to...
since the dawn of man.
In compelling people to talk. I mean, initially what I thought is it would be great if we had it included in the same section on the third page there, that a person testified at grand jury, maybe toyed with the idea of a B saying, or replacing the B with saying something that a person voluntarily provides a valid government issue photo ID to the peace officer who served the subpoena and provided the officer a statement of what the person observed and or knew of the case being investigated. But realistically, I think that's the challenge that will always remain for us. We can't compel people to give us statements. And the only the biggest hurdle that we have in this bill or any proposed or any kind of method that we use is, in this case, the information that's locked up in some of the individuals that we make contact with may be the only vehicle of which we can get to grand jury with, if that makes sense. It's for not without getting some ability to get some of that information to actually crack the case to bring it to grand jury. But that's our challenge. We appreciate the support and the efforts that Senator Bundy and all of you are trying to do to get this issue addressed, because what's happening currently without it is too high of a price, I think, for certainly the kids that are involved, as well as their families and the community as a whole.
Thank you, Chief Monaghan. Representative Guerra.
Walt, this is Les Guerra. Thanks for your help on this. I'm just wondering how long this detention will be. How long would it take at the scene? I take it this would happen at the police car. How long would it take to take somebody's fingerprints and their photograph?
Well, it'd just be a couple of minutes, actually. The photograph, just setting up a digital camera, which most of our officers carry now. The fingerprint, we do carry some little kits that we used to use for like a thumbprint in regards to arrest warrants or arrest reports. So I would suspect if it took us 5 minutes, that would be unusual. It shouldn't take that long.
And can we limit? I don't want temporarily detained to mean, you know, a half hour, bring them into the police station, let them out. I want it to be at the scene of where you pick the person up, where the police car is. Can we limit it to may temporarily detain in that place if we can come up with the words?
Yeah, something about it maybe in the immediate vicinity. I mean, if one of the things that we do as a matter of course, even with cooperative witnesses, is that we have to separate them by a little bit of a distance so that they're not communicating with each other and getting their stories mixed up with listening to what did you saw? Oh, here's what I saw. Well, that sounds better than what I remember. I thought he had a green shirt. No, he had a red shirt, you know, that kind of stuff. So we would actually physically separate them, and we could still do that at the immediate scene, but just away from each other, that's all.
Madam Chair, refer you to page 2, line 20, where it says unreasonably delaying the person or removing them from the vicinity. So it would indeed take place at the police car.
Same thing for fingerprints.
It's the same thing for fingerprints, Annie has added.
Where is the finger? Same thing for fingerprints?
Page 2, line 30.
Okay, Annie, is this due? I can't remember your answer if I asked you this before. Do other states have laws like this?
Through the chair, other states have material witness statutes. I haven't done a lot of research on them, but most states do have provisions that allow for detention of material witnesses. This, from what I understand, and I'm pinch hitting for Dean Guinelli on this, but this is a very mild version of material witnesses, from what I understand, and maybe Ms. Rice can give you more information on what other states do.
On this point, one question. You know, you could have, let's say you have, and I'm kind of talking to all of you, including you, Chief. This is Representative Gruenberg. Let's say the individual, there's just one policeman happens to be there, and she doesn't have a fingerprint kit in her car. Should there not be some provision that allows the police person to take the person to the station, get the fingerprint, and immediately return it?
Max, what I would suggest instead is we would call and have an additional unit bring the equipment to that officer.
That may be true in Anchorage, but how about in another town?
Oh, I see what you mean. You're right. I'm being egocentric here. it may be difficult for a trooper out on the road, for example, until other troopers arrive, which could be several hours later. And I would hope that they have the available equipment, but obviously I can't make that kind of guarantee.
I would just, all I've done, Chief, as you know, is just to raise issues. And so I would ask, as we look at this, maybe that's something that we want to consider, because I want this to be realistic. And maybe for some reason they'd have to take somebody down the street to get the fingerprint.
Maybe if you looked at language that basically required it to be articulated, the necessity for doing something like that. It must be articulated.
Yeah, I would say something like that. Thank you.
Okay. Nobody else is it anybody else in the audience to testify on this bill, Senate Bill 206, or anybody online? Okay, so I'm going to just close public testimony as a matter of procedure so that we can have the bill back before us for amendments and discussion. Representative Gruenberg.
Just one other thing. And the same on line 20, if they don't happen to have a camera with them in another part of this, something. I just want this to be reasonable from the law enforcement.
Senator Bundy, by the way, welcome to hell. I mean, to the Judiciary Committee, which is extremely fun in the House.
If I might respond to that, again, this is a balancing act between the rights of the citizens and the tools we give the law enforcement. And I would just initially respond that law enforcement is going to have the equipment with them if we're going to not unreasonably delay people. And we're going to give them the tools, whether they choose to use them or not, will be then on their shoulders.
Sure. Okay, and so I'll just throw this out to the committee. I'm going to hold the bill over to allow folks to work on amendments. Is there anybody ready for their amendment now? Okay.
Madam Chair, I think I am.
Okay, Representative Guerra.
I don't want to hold this if we don't have to. Look through this. I'd be much more comfortable with this bill if we said changed reasonable suspicion to probable cause, and then probable cause that the person witnessed the commission of the crime and has information material to the investigation. Information material to the investigation. I would take out that B section at line 9. I don't really like the "or if the person was in the vicinity" thing. I think that I understand why that's well motivated. I represent Fairview, and there are people in the vicinity who I would be tempted to interview to see if they had seen anything improper, especially around the Cars Gamble store, which has been such a problem there. But I do have a problem of the, you know, if you're just in the vicinity, now we don't need probable cause that you saw anything, and we don't need probable cause that you're a witness, and that just seems too broad for me.
Les, can I make a response?
Yeah.
Were you part of the? Did you hear the testimony I made to a committee earlier in regards to how we solve the Meech cases?
Sure.
You were?
Oh no, I wouldn't mind hearing that.
Oh.
Yeah.
What, basically, if you recall, Meech was the individual who shot the 4 teenagers up in Russian Jack back in the 80s. And what happened there, what really cracked the case for us, is that there was an individual who, when we first got the call that there were shots fired and they believed somebody was down inside of Russian Jack Park, that as we got there, somebody mentioned or told one of the first officers that they saw a brown van speeding away. Well, a second responding officer actually intercepted the van and stopped it. They determined they weren't the bad guy. But we took information from him. He showed ID. We determined he wasn't involved. We cut him loose. Well, what played back on that, just to kind of shorten up the whole story, was that when we got stymied with all other leads drying up, we went back and dug into the other information we had, and we went back to go talk to the driver of this van. And the van basically, he told us that he was walking through Russian Jack, he spotted a bicycle that was laying in the brush, and he told us that he was actually thinking about stealing it or taking it with him when he heard the shots, and that scared him. And he took off. Well, this individual happened to be very, very knowledgeable about bikes and had an excellent memory. And he provided us with the information that we were able to track this bike back to one particular vendor who actually sold only 12 bikes, and Charles Meech was one of them that he had sold it to. So even though the man wasn't there where the kids were being actually hit, or he didn't see that, he heard the shot, was in the area, we stopped him blocks away from the shooting because we didn't know, but he provided us with his driver's license, and we were able to recontact him. So how we solve cases sometimes involves a little bit of luck. And we certainly, if the guy had refused, and if he'd been walking, for example, not driving, where the law required him to show us his ID or his driver's license, and we asked him, without something like this, he could have said, I don't want to get involved, just leave me alone. So it's that case would have been a lot more difficult to solve if we had didn't have the circumstances we had. So it is a standard of which we use a reasonable suspicion that versus probable cause. Again, that's a standard that we use that we have that we must make that we could make an arrest on, which is much more severe than just stopping somebody and saying, "Did you hear that?"
Thanks, Walt. I think, Madam Chair, I think you convinced me of the need to be able to not just stop the person who you know saw the crime, but also a person who has information, even if they didn't, even if you didn't see them witness it. But I think then I still think I'm much more comfortable with probable cause, and then if you go to line 12. Right now, it's reasonable suspicion that the person may have information, and that's a pretty lax standard that allows a lot of stopping. I would be much more comfortable with probable cause that the person has information. Everybody may have information, but I think it should be probable cause that the person has. Then if you had any belief that the guy in the van had information, you could have stopped him, but if it was just luck that you ended up speaking to somebody in a van who had information, I think I don't want to expand it that far.
Well, it could get complicated if the person that we're stopping happens to be one of those guilty witnesses. And then the information would be quashed because we didn't have the standard of probable cause to stop them to begin with. And we'd lose that information in court, or in the court battle.
I see the problem. I mean, certainly you see somebody at the scene of the crime, they're a witness, you have probable cause, that's easy. That helps the mall shooting case. But I'm uncomfortable going beyond that. I understand the Brown van case, though. I think I'm still stuck at what I would like the bill to say would be, change reasonable suspicion to probable cause, change line 12 from person may have information to probable cause the person has information. And then I'm much more comfortable with the bill, and not being facetious here, but if we'd certainly solve a lot more crimes if we let people stop anybody on a hunch, and we would solve more crimes. But I'm uncomfortable going that direction, even though this bill doesn't say on a hunch, I'm uncomfortable going in that direction.
Representative Gruenberg.
With due respect to Representative Guerra, I'm going to take the opposite position. This is far less cause than the cause you need to actually arrest somebody. This is simply a right to detain them for a little questioning and to see if they have any knowledge of the crime. And the police have got to be able to do that at the scene as quickly as possible, or the evidence will be lost, the people will leave the scene, or their memories will fade. I have gone a number of times on ride-alongs with the police and in Anchorage, and I know how people just, and with the fire department too, actually arson stuff, and people, at least in my part of town, fade into the woodwork fast.
Madam Chair?
Representative Guerra.
Well, just on both of those points, your example is somebody at the scene, you want to stop them. My proposal would let you stop somebody at the scene. And then you mentioned that that this bill is a far lower standard than what you need to arrest somebody. That's the problem. I mean, if you're guilty, it's got to be a probable cause. If you're not guilty, it's just reasonable suspicion. If you've done nothing wrong, that seems backwards. I mean, you should have what's wrong with having, I mean, I understand your point. It's a higher standard to stop somebody if you've done something bad. But shouldn't it be a higher burden to stop somebody if you've not done something bad?
No, because you're, through the chair, you're not accusing them in a crime. Here you're just questioning them as a witness. And you're not arresting them. The question is what the standard is to take somebody into custody. That's a very serious thing. Here you're just stopping them briefly, detaining them to answer questions. And I don't think you should have to have that high a standard. You may have 20 people, and they're all leaving, and you say, just wait a minute, we're going to have to take a few minutes to sort things out and question you here. And you shouldn't need a lot of standard for that. You just take their names, see if they have anything to say, and let them go.
I propose to let you do that. Because they were there. You saw them there. They were at the scene. You would be able to stop them and ask questions.
Maybe I'm, through the chair, maybe I'm missing something. But I thought that the standard you're talking about was probable cause rather than reasonable suspicion. I thought you wanted to change that. Are you not changing that on line 5?
Yes, it would be probable cause that they witnessed. So you're talking about the people at the scene. Well, you have probable cause that they witnessed.
If I can speak up again.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Again, probable cause being the high standard that it is, if I come up and said, Les, I think you saw something here, and you wanted to be obstinate about it, you would say, prove it. And I can't, because I wasn't there when the event happened. I arrived 3 or 4 minutes later as an emergency responder. And when I get there, you could say, I just heard the shot. I came over to like everybody else to see what's going on. I don't know anything. The fact that they're standing there doesn't necessarily mean that they are guilty of anything. It means that the reasonable standard helps us not have that argument. It just says, look, all I need is some information, your name, your phone number, and did you see anything? And they can say, I'll give you my name and my number, but I didn't see anything. And that's fine. I mean, that it boils down to our ability as opposed to having somebody turn around and say, no, you say I know the law, it says probable cause, which means you have to prove that I was here. And it doesn't help us that much.
Do you want to speak, Ms. Carpinetti?
Yes, I would. Through the chair, my name is Ann Carpinetti. I represent the criminal division. I would be very concerned about adopting a probable cause standard. The courts of the United States and our Alaska courts have upheld a temporary detention to ask a person their identification so that you can follow up later if you have to or you need to. And the standard has been upheld in terms of stopping people temporarily for investigative purposes. I think making a probable cause standard would confuse people and make it more difficult for the police to investigate a crime.
Okay, let's do this real. Let's try to confine our comments now, if we can, with an eye toward an amendment. So, if there's going to be an amendment, if you want to offer it, then we can direct our discussions that way. So we find our way out of here.
That's just not how probable cause works, though. You don't have to be right that the person was a witness. Probable cause means that you had probable cause to believe the person's a witness, even if you were wrong. So if the witness says to you, I wasn't here, prove it, that has nothing to do whether you had probable cause to stop the person. The question is, did you as an officer have a strong belief that the person was there, even though you might be wrong later? So it's not a defense when the person says to you, I wasn't here, to a probable cause standard. And I think there should be a higher standard when you're dealing with innocent people than when you're dealing with people who've done something wrong.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I agree. And if we knew which were innocent and which were guilty at the outset, we could have more exacting standards. My analogy would be, reasonable suspicion. You're driving down the road and you change lanes, perhaps ineptly. The officer has a reasonable suspicion to stop to see if you are under the influence. And then, of course, there's the next step up if you're going to be arrested. But the reasonable suspicion, I think, is essential to be part of this bill. Probably not so much at the arrest, at the initial investigation, but when it comes to court, and I could see important witness testimony thrown out as lawyers argue whether the police officer actually had probable cause or not.
Okay, so what are the wishes of the committee? Representative Gruenberg?
Madam Chair, as Representative Guerra initially proposed this, he went through a number of things. If we could break this up into divide the question, that'll make it easier.
So what I'm going to do, Senator Bundy, is we've got one House bill behind yours. Our House bill deadline was last week. This is an important bill to me that came up later in the process. I'd like to get that bill out of the committee today, with all due respect. So what I'd like to do is set your bill to the side and bring your bill first up on Friday prior to our discussion on House Bill 502, the oil and gas tax. So that will also give some time for Lauren to confer with Representative Guerra and see if there's a middle ground. There may not be, but that'll give some opportunity. And then that way, when we come back here on Friday, we'll be a little bit more directed. Plus, it's the style you adopt in your committee, and I'm almost wondering if it doesn't work better.
Certainly at the will of the chair, and I would point out that there was one amendment that the chief was interested in entertaining, so we'd like to see that drafted as well.
Absolutely. And Chief Monaghan, our fax number here, do you have a pen?
Yes, I do.
Okay, it's 465-6592, and I would be happy to introduce that amendment on your behalf.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, and thank you for your testimony and your advocacy for the issue. Okay, so Senate set it aside. Thank you, Senator. And with that, we're going to have Representative Ledoux and House Bill 322. Yep. Take a brief at ease. Representative Ledoux.
Yes, Chairman McGuire and members of the House Judiciary Committee, thank you for hearing House Bill number 322. And I will now introduce my aide, Christine Marasigan, to go over the bill with you. And for the record, my name's Gabrielle Ledoux.
Thought you looked familiar.
Yes, we thought you looked familiar. And Christine, you know, an eye toward the clock at this stage, I think you
absolutely
have support, and if we could then just confine it to the areas where there might be discussion or changes, that would be great.
For the record, my name is Christine Aramir-Segan, staffer to Representative Ledoux. Thanks for the opportunity to present Safe Surrender of Infants, House Bill 322, Version Y. Has the potential to save an infant's life. There are 46 other states that have enacted this type of legislation. Alaska, Hawaii, Nebraska, and Vermont are the only states that have not.
Which
one? Alaska, Hawaii, Nebraska, and Vermont.
Really?
Have not.
Have not. The first such law was passed in the state of Texas in 1999 after 13 infants were found abandoned within a 10-month period. This is started the whole thing of this type of legislation being called Baby Moses laws. Other states have referred to this type of legislation as safe haven law. The changes, there have been a few changes from its last committee of referral. This changes the amount of time that an infant can be surrendered, and it also deletes the amount of days in which the person, when they terminate their legal support of the infant. The intent of the bill is to deter typically young and unmarried women who are concealing their pregnancies, who are giving birth in private and then disposing of the newborn's bodies. This bill would save an infant in imminent danger and enable a parent to avoid prosecution if they leave an infant at a designated safe location. We do have folks from the Office of Children's Services as well as Department of Law if you have any questions.
I don't think it's necessary. If the folks in the audience are willing to surrender your testimony safely in favor of passage of this bill, so I'll ask the question, is there anybody else in the audience that needs to testify on this bill? Anybody online? Okay. And then we'll go ahead and close public testimony, and then I'll have a motion.
Excuse me, Chairwoman McGuire.
Representative Ledoux.
Just wanted to remind you about the indeterminate fiscal.
That's note. Correct.
I'll state it on the record.
On the motion when we move it. I want the bill moved without the fiscal note.
Gotcha.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, I want to focus, if I may, and I'm going to ask everybody the same question. And it seems to me the main difference here is on page 1, line 10, the 8 days, and that's back at the end of the bill, too. It was 12 months. That's pretty long, but 31 days seems much more reasonable. I'm concerned about driving people underground so they don't deliver these babies. And if there's been some prosecution or something, that's far secondary to getting these babies into a safe environment. And I'm wondering, I'm going to ask you and everybody else, would you have a serious problem if we left it at 31 days or something close to it? I want those babies safe.
Christine, Representative Ledoux?
I guess I want the babies safe too. But what this bill is kind of geared at is the young, single woman who gets pregnant, manages to disguise the pregnancy, delivers the baby in private. And we want that person to know that, you know, she doesn't have to leave it in a trash can
right.
somewhere. She can go and deliver it in at a safe spot. So 3 days, 8 days, something like that sounded to me fairly reasonable. Once you're talking about 31 days, I mean, she really has the baby. It's not, you know, something that somebody is doing kind of at the spur of the moment without thinking and is, you know, an awful mistake. I mean, she's had the baby for a month.
Right.
So it seems a little bit different there.
Representative Gould?
May I respond? It may be, but if she wants that baby to be in a safe environment, let's err on the side of letting her do it. I mean, I hope you wouldn't oppose lengthening that.
I guess, and I can live with the will of the committee here, but the one thing that I guess I would say is you want to make sure that these babies are delivered, if they're going to be delivered, to the safe haven, that there's no problem with the abuse thing. I mean, at 30 days, a person who is willing to abandon her baby, there's a possibility that she might have abused her baby in neglected. And you don't want to get those problems. Having said all that, I see Christine passed me a note that said OCS wants 30 days, and if that's what OCS wants, I can probably live with 30 days, too.
I would hope so.
Okay, Jan?
Yeah.
Why don't you come forward? You can just pull up a seat.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jan Rutherdale, Department of Law, Civil Section, Child Protection Division, or Civil Division, Child Protection Section. And Department of Law doesn't have any legal problems with the bill, I mean, the concept of the bill. There are some wording changes and just in the structure, the way the bill is set up right now. And I guess I heard what you said about wanting to pass this out today. So I just wanted to I don't have a problem with working in the next committee or the floor or wherever it ends up next.
Is it complex what you're proposing?
Sorry?
Is it complex?
Yeah, I think what I'd like to do is I'd like to work with Jean Michelle, who drafted the original one, and just bounce off some ideas and come up with something. Well, I don't think it's simple enough that it could be just done an amendment. It's more of a structural thing. And
okay.
So that's the only comment I have. And I do apologize that I didn't bring this to Representative Ledoux's attention earlier. It's my fault. I didn't think this was going anywhere this session. So.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Guerra.
Actually, I was a little perplexed at what happened on the House floor today, where other people came in with amendments to a bill that was written as the representative wanted, and it got sent back to rules to no fault of the representatives on our own. If the administration has suggestions, I would suggest that they have them ready for the first committee in the Senate.
Okay, that's another alternative. Right, that's fine. Okay.
That's a good faith.
Yes.
If you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
Okay, so now let's hear from the department then. You weren't going to, but I'd at least like to hear on the record, if you don't mind, with respect to the 30-day issue, what that perspective is.
Poor thing. She's been here the whole meeting.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Tammy Sandoval, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Office of Children's Services. We have been working diligently with Representative Ledoux's office since this idea came to be early on, and we have gone back and forth with time limits, and what we had proposed to Representative Ledoux's office was 21 days, actually. And that's trying to, we looked to, like they did at all the other laws across the nation, and tried to come up with, and they're all over the page. There are some laws that say 3 days. There are some laws that have it much further out. And what we did, for lack of any other better evidence, is we split the difference and offer 21 days. I mean, the other thing that I just want to say for the record is that thankfully, or that we don't know, we haven't had any of these cases to even use as an example. So we're basing this just on what is going on across the nation, and trying to come to some kind of middle ground. So we don't, the department doesn't have an absolute days or length of time that we want to propose and have legislated.
The next thing I want to talk to you about is, it's my intent to not adopt the fiscal note to go along with this bill. And I just want to kind of discuss that with you. It's the 26th of April, and it would involve a finance referral for an optional program. To me, a fiscal note means this is absolutely going to require this, and therefore it must go. When I read your fiscal note, what I saw was a lot of hopes and dreams and wishes that I don't disagree with all due respect, with respect to education and advocacy and so on, but those aren't necessarily mandated. There's nothing about the bill that mandates that. And so, with all due respect, I'd like the motion to be made to go forward, to have this bill go forward without that fiscal note attached. If it doesn't, there's likely not enough time in this session to get that forward. And again, I wish every department would submit a fiscal note for things they're considering doing. I mean, it doesn't happen. So I kind of wanted to hear what you thought about that.
We don't seem to have one.
Yeah, there was one that came to us that, like I say, I.
Madam Chair, my response to that would be that I agree that passing the legislation is most important. The dilemma that we often face in-house is that there are lots of good ideas and things that we wish we could do, and without the funds, this is going to be a bill that's going to, or a law that will be on the books that if a terrible thing happens, and this happens, and people didn't know, I guess I just want to say for the record that I hope that then I will look for whatever ways that we can do to educate the community and make sure that people know about this bill passing, and making sure that the targeted folks that we're trying to get at know. But in the absence of having any funds to promote and do that kind of community awareness, I'm afraid that we may be held responsible for why didn't you go educate and make sure that this young woman who may come forward, I didn't know. Well, why didn't OCS tell you? I mean, I think that passing the legislation is the most important thing, and I think 46 states think it's a good idea too, and so I'm interested in if you pass it without the fiscal note. I can understand why you would do that. I guess it's just it's an issue about the Office of Children's Services and the department being held responsible for things that they sometimes can't control.
And just with all due respect, the fiscal note thing is one of those just, it's a complex subject. There are things that I think absolutely require fiscal notes that seem to never get them. I can think of other situations where other bills that have come through this committee that I know for a fact that are creating a new law, a new offense, for example, that somehow don't have any fiscal impact at all, when we know that people are going to be charged with the crime and there's going to be money that's associated with that. It's with no disrespect that I say it, but I fear that it will delay the bill in a way that might kill it.
Madam Chair, point well taken, and I think we both understand each other and know that we both want the best thing.
At a minimum, perhaps even an indeterminate fiscal note could be created at some point down the line, since I think it's all speculative anyway. Representative Gruenberg, did you have? Okay. Is there an amendment to change the number of days?
No, I think Christina had something that she wanted to say. Could she?
Madam Chair, could I just
your hand up?
Sure, Representative Guerra.
So speaking from the perspective of somebody who's all his bills are probably going to die in the Senate this year. I'd like to see somebody have some success. Wish it could be a Democrat, but that's not going to happen. It seems to me that my comment before, which is people should have their amendment, they're ready for the first Senate committee. I'm really uncomfortable about picking a number out of thin air right now here, and I think Representative Ledoux is very open to the idea of coming up with the appropriate day limit. And you might also consider maybe a day limit following the release from the hospital, but I don't know. I don't really care that much. But I think all of that probably should be talked about with Representative Ledoux and changed after consideration in the first Senate committee, so that we're not picking numbers here that I don't feel comfortable with.
Representative Gruenberg?
I think Christina wanted to say her hand was up. Could she speak? Did you want to say something?
Actually, for the record, I did want to bring up that there have been infants found abandoned in Alaska. And I want to correct that, because in the last committee of referral, I did not have this information at that time, so I wanted to make sure that at some point, it's amazing what a difference a day makes, what you can find out. And, so I've got several articles from the Anchorage Daily News dating from 1986 to 1995 where newborn babies, boys and girls, anywhere from 1 day to 7 days old, found abandoned. And I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of that, that it does happen in Alaska.
To help in our fiscal note situation, perhaps we want to see if we can get some media coverage of the bill passing as well, so that folks out there will know that we've joined the ranks of the majority of the other states that have adopted this really important law, too. So with that, is there an amendment or not?
Yeah.
Representative Gruenberg.
There's going to be.
Okay.
We've got the information here, and they can always change it in the Senate, but I think that we've heard enough that I feel comfortable going with the OCS recommendation, and I would move that on page 1, line 10, we change 8 days to 21 days, and the same page 3, line 19, and if they want to make some other change in the Senate, they can do it. The other stuff that the Department of Law was saying, they can do that. We can either do it if it's technical. Could you do it on the floor? No, don't want to do it on the floor. Okay. We could do it in the Senate or whatever, but I'd like, this is a policy call, and I move 21 days.
I object just briefly.
Representative Guerra.
The information we have, we have the information to pick a day. The information we have is OCS coming here saying, I don't know, we just picked a number halfway between. That's what I'm talking about. We don't have information other than a number that's halfway between numbers that we don't understand.
I understand, and it's going to be a judgment call. The other states are all over the map, and I want to take the path of least resistance. 8 days is not enough, in my opinion. 21 days is certainly reasonable. If somebody wants to change it, I see Representative LaLue has her hand.
Yes, I just wanted to let you know how we ended up with the 8 days. We ended up with the 8 days. We originally had 3 days, and we picked 3 days because it seemed like, you know, quite a few of the states had a three-day limitation. So that's the way we ended up with the 3 days. In Hess, Representative Seaton wasn't comfortable with the 3 days, so we ended up expanding it to 8 days. So,
well, as the bill was introduced, was 12 months, and that's when I signed on to it. And I just, unless somebody has a serious objection, I just don't think 8 days is enough. A person can get overwhelmed and realize that they really can't care for that child. 8 days, they're maybe in postpartum depression. This gives them a little more time.
Let me take a brief interview. Back in order, Representative Groenberg.
So that's Amendment 1.
Okay, change, Amendment number 1.
Change 8 to 21.
Is there an objection?
I withdraw my objection.
Okay, the objection's been withdrawn. Further objection to Amendment number 1? Hearing none, Amendment number 1 carries. Representative Cott.
Madam Chair, that would be after we... No, let's do it now. Madam Chair, I would move that the committee authorize the chair to adopt a zero fiscal note from Health and Social Services. Report out of committee with a zero fiscal note with the understanding that there's going to be more work in progress down the line, and perhaps there may end up being a small fiscal note on the other side. But I think a lot of what we can accomplish, at least from what I've heard, can be done so through a number of means, via PSAs or just a poster in a physician's office that recognizes this new practice that's on the books, and future parents may have this opportunity. I mean, it'd be pretty simple. I don't know how you would do that. I mean, send a letter out to all, I don't know. That'd be a tough one.
That's one of the most clear motions I've ever heard.
But
she's got a bloody nose on her.
Oh, so, Madam Chair, the motion is to adopt a zero HES fiscal note.
Okay, and so is there an objection to that motion and to moving the bill out? Okay, actually, so first was the motion on the fiscal note. Then we'll make a motion on moving it out. Okay, so any objection to that motion? Hearing none, that motion carries, and now Representative
Madam Chair, so then I move House Bill 322.
Wait, one more question.
Representative Groenberg?
And I'm sorry, I'm just looking at this. Some of the, do you have these charts, this chart, about the other states? They do or they don't?
Should I submit
it? For the record, you're saying there's a state comparison chart.
Yeah, there is, and just a question, and it's something I just noticed as I was looking through here. Some of these states say a parent or a parent's, P-A-R-E-N-T apostrophe S, agent. Do you want to include a parent's agent? They don't want to do it.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So the motion.
House Bill 322, Safe Surrender Babies, attached fiscal, zero fiscal note. As authorized by the Judiciary Committee and individual recommendations.
Okay, any objection? Hearing none, the bill is moved and we're adjourned.
Thank you very much.